Our guest today, Daryl Mosley. Daryl has a brand new album on Pinecastle Records. The name of the album is Small Time Dreamer. We're going to talk to Daryl at length, play some songs, all tunes that he's selected from the album, and we will start off this segment with Transistor Radio, which I've played before on Unreal Bluegrass. I just like the notion of this transistor radio, and maybe for some of you, you need an explanation, and Daryl will give you that in just a minute. I remember it very well and very fondly. To the audience of Unreal Bluegrass, you just heard Transistor Radio, a great song, the first cut on an album entitled Small Town Dreamer from my guest today, Daryl Mosley. Daryl Mosley, how are you doing?
Thanks, Steve. I'm good. How about you?
I'm just thrilled to be chatting with anybody and happy to be talking with you, especially because this album is just excellent. It's just a wonderful, wonderful collection of songs, and we'll get into more of that later, but I will just tell you this as a starting statement. I'm from a small town. This album is like walking through my streets as a child, and all those memories that come back. It really is amazing to me that you've captured all those things in a very entertaining way. Transistor Radio being the one that we started with, and Transistor Radio, man, if you had a transistor radio when you and I were kids, you were in touch with the world.
Well, for me, that was the whole, that was the beauty of it. You know, those of us that were raised prior to the technology that we have now, you know, before cable and all of that, you know, I learned with my little radio, especially at night, you know, that I put it up in the wind to get better reception.
That's
and
right.
First of all, I could pick up baseball, which was one of my first loves.
So
I'd listen to the Cardinals game or the Reds game or the Braves game, whatever came in clear. But where I live, I grew up in Waverly, Tennessee, which is about an hour west of Nashville and about 2 hours east of Memphis. So I was close enough that I could pick up the Opry and WSM in Nashville. And I could also get Red Hot and Blue and some of the great R&B music and stuff that was coming out of Memphis. So
yeah.
I had this really eclectic, you know, experience of music and stuff from everywhere. And it was, well, it was life-changing. It really was.
It is hard to children today, and I say children, anybody that's not as old as we are, let's put it that way. And before the internet, you can't imagine how important it was to have a transistor radio. And the great thing about them, Daryl, and you went through this too, because it would almost be like as the wind blew through the neighborhood, you'd have to chase that signal down just a little bit, could dial it in and get just a little closer, and then you would lose
it,
and you'd have to go back and find it. Just a hair of that turn of that knob would get you back in contact. And it just was an amazing thing to be able to dial those things. And at night, all the clear channels popped in, and for the young people, clear channel stations, back in the days of Daryl and me as children, those were stations that were allowed to pretty much had free access to that broadcast all night. There was nothing that, like in my area, 700 WLW, which is probably where you heard the Reds, at nighttime,
yep,
there was nothing to compete with that frequency across the coast. That's why they were called the Nation Station. So you could get all those stations, but at nighttime, you had to really dial them in. It was just an amazing thing.
Yeah, that was, you know, to me, what I remember in the wintertime, you know, all the daytime stations had to sign off at dark.
That's right.
And so the clear channel stations were on longer, or seemed like longer to me. I could get them earlier.
Yeah.
And so many is the night that I would, you know, listen to, like I said, WLS or, you know, whatever station I could pick up and heard amazing music that I would have never stumbled across otherwise.
You couldn't have. And like you said, you were getting stuff. When you're in your area, you could pull in Memphis, whole different sound,
yeah,
which, by the way, as we all know, the blues and that Memphis sound and a little bit of New Orleans blues crept into Bill Monroe's music. We know that for
yep,
a fact. So you were pulling in all those things that eventually, well, let's say before you, kind of all combined into what we now know as bluegrass and from the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe. But that was different to me. I'm staying on this topic too long, Daryl, because I remember it like it was yesterday. And the transistor was no bigger than your pocket, shirt pocket. Little
yeah,
radio, and if you had one little earphone that sounded like, you know, a tiny little earphone, you were in business.
And it was, yeah, you're right. It's hard to overstate how important that was to our generation.
You know, it wasn't a stereo broadcast. All those were mostly
yeah,
AM stations that bounced around
yep,
the world. But in at nighttime, especially because you didn't want to get caught, maybe listen to the radio at 2 a.m, you had one little earplug. Which was about as tinny as you could get. And by today's standards, I don't think anybody would even dare listen to that type of an earplug that we had in those days. But, man, it was just eye-opening, ear-opening, and mind-expanding. And I love that song. I've played that song before, Transistor Radio, It is a wonderful album. There are 12 cuts on the album, Daryl. I'm so happy you're available to chat about it. And I don't want to take up any more time, but I wanted to tell you and express to you that to me, and I'm sure like a lot of listeners, when they hear this album, it is like a walk down a small town. If you're from a small town or know about a small town, all these things are very relatable, and that's just a great achievement.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, when I first started really pursuing songwriting, you know, trying to really understand the craft and get good at it, there's a great writer in Nashville named Larry Schell who, when I was just a teenager, he kind of took me under his wing, and he would let me show up at his office, and if he was there, he'd bring me in, and he'd let me play songs, and he would tell me what was good and what wasn't and what worked and why it didn't work. And, you know, and of course he never made a dime off of me. He did this strictly because he loved songs and songwriters and saw that I was hungry. But Larry gave me some great advice early on. He said, write what you know. And so that's what I've done. I'm a small town guy. I love small towns and small town people. And I know their stories and you know, they have big lives in these little small towns. And so to be able to capture some of those experiences and realize that they are shared experiences. It's not something that's it's exclusive to my town. It was also true in your town and somebody else's town. I love that. I love that people, you know, relate to that.
And, you know, too, Daryl, they don't have to be small towns. Like when I grew up in a small town, you did also. They don't have to be small towns because so many of these concepts and so many of these memories – you can just change a few words about it, and everybody has those same things if they're lucky enough to run into people and have that connection, whether it's music or culture or whatever. It doesn't have to be a small town, but it was everywhere in a small town. And I think this whole album picks out all those things with the religious nature, the smaller, let's say smaller but more full memories and detail, the detail. You picked out the detail of all of those things that some of us experienced and maybe forgot until they listened to an album like this, Small Town Dreamer, where they can all of a sudden pull those things back in and say, yeah, well, we didn't have a Waverly train disaster, but we had fires and things happening. You know, you think about those things and the horror, but also of the unity that it brings. The Hillbilly Dust song to me is, I knew people exactly like that. I want you to talk a little bit about that. We're going to bounce around a bit as we get a feel for the album. My guest is Daryl Mosley, and we're talking about his new album, Small Town Dreamer, on Pinecastle. But Hillbilly Dust to me is something that I knew people exactly like as you described.
Yeah, you know, this is a farming community too, and you know, some farms are, most of them are not huge, but you know, there's a lot of people that have lots of farming in their heritage, and you know, and it's such an important part of who they are, and so yeah, I agree. I know people that they lived their whole life, you know, that's what mattered to them was being on that farm and working the land, and you know, their faith was strong, and you know, they love their family and the family stuck together and you know, and that's basically their entire story if you look at it in a nutshell. But you know, these are, you know, really, really strong, wonderful, warm, salt of the earth kind of people, and you know, I love being able to, you know, paint those pictures for people like that. Oftentimes we think it's, you know, you have to have this big life and this big existence.
Right.
But to me, the stories are in those people.
Oh, you do. And your stories are so great. Your stories are so great. And Hillbilly Dust, a person like that, they're very solid and very grounded. They may not be proselytizing or preaching, but if you really get down to what they're about, they'll tell you, me and God. You know, I'm doing this and God's taking care of this. But I don't say boast, but you know what I mean? They're very reserved, and they're working hard, and they're devoting their life to their religion and their faith in God, and those people are everywhere. And unless someone like you finds a story that's relatable and puts it in such a great song, people forget that those people are maybe the most quiet and the most devout and the hardest working people you're going to come across.
Well, you know, the funny thing is when you look at, and I know that if I look at my musical heroes, if I read their biographies, you know, they were all inspired initially by somebody else, somebody that wasn't, you know, renowned, somebody who wasn't famous, somebody who wasn't wealthy. It was somebody in their town or somebody that taught them how to how to play guitar, or somebody who taught them,
right.
you know, about their faith. And, you know, that's where those roots come from for all of us. And it's easy to get caught up in thinking, well, you know, I admired, you know, it's easy to admire Mr. Monroe, you know, but Mr. Monroe was quick to point out that, well, Uncle Penn is the one that showed me how to do
that's
this.
Right.
And, you know, what we know about, you know, Uncle Penn, is strictly from Mr. Monroe.
That's right.
You know, Pendleton Vandeveer, when that was the last name, would have never, you know, would probably have disappeared from the our common, you know, mind if it had not been for him being, you know, idolized and memorialized, I guess is a better word, in that song. And so that's what these people are to me.
And those songs were you're talking about Bill Monroe and songs about people, and maybe there's not anything written about him, but those songs and that music, those were the ultimate, we'll say, in the nature of a song, the ultimate oral history, the ultimate preserving of history through oral words, and they happen to be in a song and a melody, but they almost always have a true basis, and like I know that we all know people, I do, you do, from the that would strike right up against the hillbilly dust, the last of his kind. It follows as the third cut, again, a very similar type of a feeling. I want to talk about that, then I want to talk about the Waverly train disaster, but let's talk a little bit about Daryl. When we're talking to Daryl Mosley, let's talk a little about Daryl, the last of his kind. This whole album is so, gets right into the heart of the listeners, I think, and I touch, maybe it's just me, I don't know, but I have this very similar circumstances in life. A lot of people do, but let's talk a little bit about The Last of His Kind, if you wouldn't mind. Then I'm going to jump down to the Waverly train disaster.
Sure. I'm the youngest member, I guess. It's an informal club, but I'm old enough now that I get invited to go down to the cafe and sit at the liar's table on some mornings. That's what they call it. Anyway. And these are mostly, you know, mostly retired businessmen from our town, and, you know, they sit around and they talk local news and sports and politics and make fun of one another and that sort of thing. You know, but these men mean so much to me. You know, there's so much wisdom in what they say and so much experience. You know, my dad was a guy that was like that, you know, one of these guys who can do lots of different things well and, you know, but these guys, sometimes they'll get to talking about the direction that the world is going in and how it's changed so dramatically and so quickly. And I think sometimes they feel a little lost in the shuffle because they don't really know how they fit in anymore. And I'm thinking, you know what? And the sad thing is these guys are getting older and we're losing these guys. And these are the guys that I still look to, you know, as you know, we're speaking, you know, before,
right.
Earlier, Sonny Austin was one of those guys,
absolutely.
You know,
that I
turned to to tap into that wisdom, yeah. Because they've done it all before and they've made the mistakes and can help me avoid them. And so I just wanted to honor those guys in a song that truly just represented who they were at their very, you know, at their very foundation.
And the thing about them too, yes, you say Liars Club. I know exactly what you're talking about. And yes, it would be a great source for their experience. They would also puff a bit, and sometimes they might be. And when it happened, people might, you know, check them back or call them down a little bit. But it was all laughed off. I mean, you know, if there was any kind of disagreement, it was gone by next time. So everybody really could just have this kind of free change of ideas and historical perspective and bring it back to some point in the conversation. Disagreements didn't mean that I'm never going to sit at this table with you again. They all came back right. The next time. It was just part of life, is to disagree and remember differently. And I mean, what the heck fun would it be if everybody remembered exactly the same thing? You would never have to go to these things.
Exactly right. And, you know, I'm aware when I sit with these guys, you know, of the things that they've experienced that I didn't. You know, most of these guys are veterans. You know, a lot of these guys served in battle. You know, they have seen businesses succeed and fail and then rebuilt, and you know they have raised families and experienced things that I haven't. And so to me, it would be foolish to have the opportunity to sit around those kinds of conversations and not.
Yep.
Not become a better person, grow from that.
And you need to learn when to just listen and take it in.
Yes, sir.
Yep. And there's so much to be gained, not always just from the stories, but the tone and the manner that they say these things and the way they they retell these stories that they've lived, and if there's something that you can't describe unless you're there, then you just have to absorb a lot of that, and you have to reflect when you leave. I always did when I left those. Well, we talked about Sonny, but I mean, I would drive home thinking about everything we talked about, and he was a great source of that for me as well as a good friend. But those are important things, and like you said, I don't know those gentlemen, those people are dying off because of their age, but I don't know that they're going to be replaced in that same sort of setting again. I hope so, but I don't know if it's going to be allowable for a while where you can sit and tell stories and disagree.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I was really thinking about that. One of the lines in that song is that, you know, we'll be less of a people when the last of him is gone. And that's what I mean by that, is that I think we are a stronger people when we're able to disagree and to share different opinions and ideas and you know, to disagree without being disagreeable. Yeah. And I think you're right, that's a lost art.
It's like, Daryl, it's like when we were playing games as a kid, baseball, football, whatever, and you're in the game, you're really intense, and after you're just like, hey, shake hands, good game. And you come back the next day and beat each other up again, so to speak. I mean, but, you know, it was always like, hey, that was great. You know, it was fun. You might have had a busted lip or whatever, but good game, and you go home. And that's over with. I don't know where we've lost that ability to reach out, but so much of your album here makes me think that we need to go find it. Listen, I want to skip down to a real story. The Waverly train disaster happened in 1978. I was surprised it was that. I looked it up. In your town, and it's a real event. I want you to talk about that a little bit, but it's an amazing, frightening story.
Yeah, well, I was just a kid, but I certainly remember it. You know, the LNN train, of course, it's CSX now, but, you know, it ran through our town and has for many, many years. It goes back, I guess, as far as the Civil War. But in 1978, we had a derailment right in town, and a number of cars came off, and two of those cars were tanker cars carrying propane.
Yeah, propane.
And in the process, after the derailment of them trying to transfer the propane from one of the downed cars to a truck, it ignited, and I mean, just leveled, you know, a big section of downtown, burnt businesses and houses, and a number of people were killed. Some instantly, and some lived a day or so, and then died. And you know, and it was, you know, it was hard. There was a lot of people that obviously were directly or indirectly impacted. And like I said, I remember it. I went to school with a couple of guys who lost parents in the explosion. But I wanted a long time. I thought about writing a song about it, but I wanted to write one that was melodically in the same vein of like those old historic songs like the Wreck of the 97 or the West Virginia mining disaster, you know, that actually told those stories in that kind of haunting, mountainous kind of way.
Right.
But more importantly, I wanted to be accurate. So I actually reached out to some people that I know that I'm friends with who are actually survivors of this. We actually have two or three here that were there the day it happened and were injured in the blast. And because I wanted to be as historically accurate as I could. And so to the best of my ability, that song is exactly the way it happened.
Am I right? I was looking it up, not on my transistor radio. I was looking it up on Google today. 16 people died. Is that correct?
Yeah, sure.
Man, can you imagine that? Now, you know, 1978, I was, I was in law school. I know what I was doing. I never heard a word about it. It's just down in Tennessee, not that far from me. But can you imagine if it happened today? There would be, you know, pretty much 24-hour. But I don't remember this at all.
Yeah. It was a different news cycle then. You know, it was the headline story on the national news that night. Walter Cronkite talked about it.
Okay.
But within a day or so, it had moved out of the news cycle. Yeah. And now, you know, of course, the news hangs around longer now because there's so many other outlets.
Well, there's so many outlets and there's so much money to be paid by being – this is – I don't go into an editorial. I don't want to, but I think the 24-hour thing is endemic to maybe some of these Liars Club tables going away because you can't – you know what I'm saying? I don't want to get on that too much. But you wanted
to –
You wanted to go to another cut, great cut from the Small Town Dreamer album, talking to Daryl Mosley, having a good time. Daryl and I have never chatted. I played your music, but you wanted to cut to He's With Me. I want you to do the intro for that. We'll listen to it, then I'll come back and talk to you.
Well, you know, like a lot of people in my part of the world, you know, the first singing I ever did was in church. And so I've been raised up singing gospel music and being around, you know, the Christian church experience my whole life. And but I had a pastor years ago, Brother Don Atkinson. He's passed away now. Wonderful, wonderful, godly man. And I in a sermon one time, and this was probably 30 years ago or more, he said, you know, as long as I am here, I know that God's with me. And when I'm no longer here, I know I'll be with him. So I'm good either way. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot that. And it just kind of locked somewhere back in my memory. And so when I was doing some songwriting with Rick Lang, and I had mentioned that to Rick, I was telling him this story. And once we started talking about the song, wrote very, very, very quickly. And Jeanette Williams, her longtime friend of mine, came in and sang harmony on it. And it's really one of my favorite cuts from the record.
That's a good one. Let's play. For the audience, we're going to play He's With Me, then I'll be back and talk to Daryl Mosley about a few more songs off of this album. So hold on. We'll be right back. All right, there it was. He's With Me. Daryl, you did a great job introducing that song, and it's a very touching song. So many of these are on this album. The very last song, Sing Me a Song About a Train, another train song, but this is a little bit more up-tempo and upbeat, whereas the Waverly train disaster, it's really hard to be upbeat about that. But I thought the last cut, Sing Me a Song About a Train, you got to have train songs. You have two. You have several gospel tunes with Mama's Bible and the one you just described, But Sing Me a Song About a Train, the last cut on here. I always wonder why people choose. Some people don't have a specific reason why they open with a cut and end with a cut, but the last tune, Sing Me a Song About a Train, why did that end up your album?
When I get older and as a teenager, and I sit on the hood of my car and play guitar and just wait for the train to come by, there was just something to me powerful about that big train, you know, shooting through town. But many years ago, Danny Roberts, who is a longtime friend of mine with the Grassfields,
right.
And Danny and I were in the band New Tradition together for many years back in the 90s, and Danny and I were writing years ago and had the idea for that song. And so we'd always talked about pitching it, getting it recorded. We never did because, you know, he and I had written it and kind of forgotten about it. And so we started pulling out songs for this album. I said, you know, we never got that song recorded, and I think I'd love to cut it. And it just felt good. It was fun to do. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to be just a great energetic way to wrap up the album.
Yeah, I think so. Just a nice up-tempo and like I said, not as ominous as the Waverly train disaster. Well, what could be if you're writing about a real train event? What's worse than that than the old 97, I guess, whatever we remember about that from the old songs. But my goodness, a song on here that is just a pure love song, I think, is You Are the Reason.
Yeah, you know, I've always loved simple love songs. And, you know, it's funny. People think that you hear a simple love song and you think, well, that must have been easy to write. But in my experience, those are some of the hardest ones to write, to be able to strip away all of the unnecessary stuff and just say the very basics on something that's that powerful and that, you know, that emotional. It's hard to do. And, you know, but I've always marveled at writers who could do that, you know. Some of the great, you know, country songs like You're My Best Friend and that sort of thing that was able to do that. And I was actually in Branson, Missouri, performing out there and woke up in the middle of the night and had the idea for the song and ended up grabbing the guitar and just wrote that actually sitting on the edge of the bed. And that's all it is. It's just a simple, direct, you know, I do what I do because at the end of the day I get to come home to you.
That's
and
right.
I think that's what a lot of us would like to say if we could say it, and I hope to think that's what a lot of people would like to hear, you know, if their loved ones say. So
it's a beautiful song, and of course, the reason I think I'm not a songwriter, I've never even tried because I can't. There are so many songs written about love and relationships and this type of feeling, but so when you write a new one, it's really something that's off of the curve because there's been so many before. So when you say, it appears to be a simple love song. It's more complicated than that. When you write a new tune and a new melody with a new sentiment, with all the billions and billions of songs that have been written about love and relationships, you have a new one now, and it's different and it's beautiful. And I just think that's a great tribute.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, those love songs are always the hardest for me, you know, and I think that's why you're right. I mean, those kinds of emotions have been have been sung and written about, and poems and prose written about for, you know, many years. And you sometimes wonder, well, what can I bring new to it? But this was just a song, like I said, that just kind of expressed what I was trying to say at the moment, and I'm just really proud of how it turned out.
And maybe that's how they have to come to you. I want to ask you before we get further along, and I'm not going to let you go because I don't want to keep you all day. Your writing experience, do you songs come to you like You Are the Reason? Do you work? I know you have co-writers. You have Rick Lang on at least a song or two. How is your, what's your writing process?
You know, it's actually a couple different things. Co-writing is good for me because it keeps me focused on and thinking about writing. You know, if I just wait for inspiration, it's easy as a writer to get lazy about that. You know, at least I know if, you know, if I'm writing on Tuesday at 10 a.m. with Rick, then I'm preparing for that. So that keeps me focused, and that's a good thing. I try to keep my radar up for things that people say or things that I might hear that I think might trigger those emotions. And so I keep, you know, in my phone, I just keep a little list of ideas and lines that I've heard that I like, or something that I read in a book or a magazine that caught my attention. And I just kind of let that simmer, you know. But then, you know, I always keep a guitar handy, so I'll start, you know, looking at the list, and I'll just start singing. I'll honestly start playing chords and just start singing the line and seeing where it goes. And oftentimes, that's where the song starts. It like the melody and the words just kind of start coming at the same time, and a line will follow that line, and before I know it, you know, the song is, you know, for the most part, built.
Interesting. Talking to Daryl Mosley, if you're just tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass, Tim Stafford, your first time Tim was on the show, he was talking about notebooks and a notebook in his pocket. And I said, you must be a lot of fun at like a gathering where you're stopping to write little things down. And then he started using a little recorder. Same thing, though, every time, like you're talking about. Great songwriters, and they hear a phrase, and they want to come back to it later and find a way to just look it over in a different light, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. I mean, how many songs must you have, Daryl, that have never come to fruition or never been recorded or just never finished? It doesn't mean they won't be tomorrow, but so many little ideas that you must keep together.
Yeah, well, you know, I've learned that, you know, it's hard to anticipate where the song is going to go. You know, Harlan Howard, the great, legendary country songwriter, mm-hmm. he said that, you know, a lot of your songs are going to be pencil sharpeners. That's what he called them. And he said they're not going to be any good. They're not going to go anywhere, but they keep you thinking like a songwriter. And I've had songs that I thought, man, this is a really good idea. It's a real strong hook. It's a strong idea. And I finish the song, and it just kind of lays there. It just never really pulls me and jumps off the page. And then other times I've had an idea, and I'm thinking, I'm not sure about this. And then before you know it, it's really strong and really put together. And there's no way to really control or anticipate that. So I just try to kind of, like I said, keep my radar up for things that people say, or even shared experiences, things that I went through or I've experienced that maybe other people did as well. That we all think that we are independent. We think we are all on an island. But the truth is, we have many, many shared experiences, and so when I as a writer can tap into that, then that's good for everybody. Because what I want is, I want you to hear the song and say, "Wow, that's my story."
Yeah. Well, yeah, boy, for me, you nailed it on this one. In the song I want to talk about, I Can't Go Home Anymore, and then I want to try to get to the last one we want you to introduce, and we've kind of covered the main themes of the album, but tell me a little bit about I Can't Go Home Anymore, and I'll tell you why I wanted you to talk about that one.
Well, you know, when I was 15, my dad he bought a farm. My daddy was raised on a farm and wanted to have one, and so when I was 15, mom and daddy sold a little house in town and bought this little farm. But by that point in my life, I was already working after school and on the weekends, so I wasn't there as much, And then I was driving, so I was home even less. And so I never got emotionally attached to the farm the way I did the little house in town. And so that's the little house in town's always been my, you know, where I grew up. And so I would drive by it every, you know, year or so just to see it and to reminisce and to drive up in the neighborhood where I rode my bicycle and that sort of thing.
Yep.
But I'll never forget a time that I drove by there, and I'm looking up at the house, and I'm kind of reminiscing and thinking about all these things. And it took me a minute to realize there was a guy in the doorway looking down at me. And he had this bewildered look on his face. And I know he's thinking, who is this strange man looking at my house? And I'm probably looking at him like, who is this strange man living in my house? You know, it was just weird. And it was that moment that I realized, you know what, I know every square inch of that house. And I know the backyard. And I've got hundreds of memories. And yet I am a stranger here.
Yep.
And there was one of those, you know, that's a shared experience.
Exactly.
That's something that most of us are not living in the house we grew up in.
No.
Most of us are emotionally invested in a place that we no longer have access to.
You're right.
And once all that registered, you know, the song wrote pretty quick, and it's always been one of the favorite things I've ever written.
The funny thing about it is my experience is almost identical. I used to ride my bike back to my hometown and to all the guys I grew up with, and we'd go fishing or, you know, climbing trees or doing whatever you do when you're stupid young kids and having fun out in nature. And the first time you realize that, that's my home, and there's some. What are they doing in my rooms? What are they doing on those stairs where we used to fall down? What are they doing? What are you doing? You almost like, oh, but then you realize that's their place for memories. Now, the thing that made me chuckle in this song was mention of the screen door, because I will bet you the screen door probably didn't have a latch. If it did, it had a hook, and that was it. And the screen door was usually just flapping. I mean, you know, it wasn't a storm door. Okay, as the suburbs grew up, people got storm doors, which were doors. But the screen door was just always like this, you know, this thing that was there, and you could hook it if you wanted to with an eye hook. But I mean, it was just a, I don't know. I don't have a screen door anymore. And I heard that song and I heard your words, and I thought, yeah, I miss the screen doors on those old houses.
Yeah, that's you know, I guess I don't know if they still sell them or still make them, but yeah.
I don't know. I don't see them.
That, you hear that little squeak where it pulls that chain, that's
yep.
The spring.
Yep.
And then you hear that pop when it pulls back too.
Yep.
And then some lady in the house saying, quit slamming the screen.
That's exactly right. You know why I think they disappeared? Because we didn't have it at all growing up, and mostly through high school, central air conditioning. I think they got replaced because what would they be? Think about it. Why would they be there? Because, you know, first of all, we never locked the door when I was a kid. Not the front door, not any of the doors. They were always unlocked, but you had that screen door there too. But I think that may have been where they went. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
You know, that makes sense. I never thought about that.
Sort of does. Daryl, I'm having a great time chatting with you. I'm taking up an awful lot of your time, but I want you to do the introduction to one more song on the album, Bringing Simple Back Home. Talk about that one. I'll let you go.
Yeah. Well, the idea was, there was another one that I wrote with Rick, and it was kind of his idea. And, you know, Rick's funny because Rick is from, you know, New Hampshire, and I'm from, you know, the South. But yet we are kindred spirits, and lots of the things that we remember growing up. But that was kind of the whole point, is that, you know, it's on the moments that I get kind of caught up in the speed of living right now, you know, it's easy to catch yourself trying to stay on that treadmill, and it's just hard. And those of us that were raised at a slower pace, I think we can only do that so long. And so we have to have some kind of way to take a break from that. And, you know, some people fish and some people, you know, have other hobbies or whatever. And so to me, it's the whole essence of that song is about being able to step away from all the things that's stressing you out and just breathe again and just focus on the things in life that really, really matter to you, you know, your friends and family and that sort of thing. But it has a neat little groove to it, and it was it's a fun addition to the record, I think.
You mentioned Rick Lang. The listeners of this program will know that a couple of weeks ago Rick Ferris was on the show, and Rick co-writes with Rick. Rick Ferris is in Kansas City. Or out that way, and then you got Rick Lang, who is up like northeast. So all their stuff is long distance communications, and he talks about Rick Lang in the same way that you do, that I hear you say, and your connection with him and the similarities and how he connects with ideas that you have. So it's kind of neat that name pops up twice in the last month as being someone that's a good song.
Well, and one of the things that modern technology has given us, you know, the new age is the ability to do that, to pull up, you know, on my computer, and I can see and talk to Rick, and he can see and talk to me. It's, you know, in fact, I actually wrote an article for the Ivy Mae Songwriters group, and it was called Co-Writing with George Jetson. And that's basically what it's about, is being able to utilize those tools that we saw as kids, thinking that, man, that's a million years in the future, and here we are writing bluegrass songs using that same technology.
And that'll never go, not all of it will go away. It'll never go away. It's back. It's good. It's going to last in some form, and I think it's good overall. It's nice when everybody can get together, but that'll never go back. It'll always be present.
I agree.
All right. Cool. Listen, so that's a great introduction to bring Simple back. And, gosh, Darryl, it's been great chatting with you. I hope I've given you enough chance to discuss what you wanted to about this really great new album, Small Town Dreamer, on Pinecastle. It's a great label. You have a lot of great people with you on here. And
well,
I've got
a really good team. I appreciate that.
Yeah, good. All right, we're going to play this. I'll let you go. And Darryl Mosley, be good. We'll find you somewhere when everything opens up, and I'll catch up with you out on the road somewhere.
Steve, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.